From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Years that debts must be canceled in full, not just in part. And this weekend, the G8 agreed to 100% cancellation of the debt for 18 nations. We are concerned, however, that this is only a
100% debt cancellation for 18 of the world's poorest nations. After years of campaigning, it's a reality. We'll speak with Jubilee USA. Today, the Senate will apologize for lynching. The 1964 Mississippi murder trial of three civil rights activists will open. While Al-Qaeda is synonymous with terrorism, we'll look at one of the greatest at issues of terrorism in this country, and that is white supremacy. We'll have a conversation with an FBI whistleblower.
And domestic extremism are not a thing of the past. As an FBI undercover agent, I worked inside these groups, and I know that they're dedicated, organized, and dangerous, and they need to be paid attention to.
And a conversation with the head of the Iraqi trade union movement in the oil industry. Public sector unions were banned under Saddam Hussein. The U.S. occupation law continued the tradition. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 75 people died on Saturday in the deadliest day since the U.S. launched Operation Lightning to hunt down members of the Iraqi resistance. In Baghdad, 11 people were killed in a car bombing in a Shiite neighborhood. 11 Iraqi construction workers died after their minibus came under fire. 21 bodies were also discovered in western Iraq. In Basra, the head of the region's police academy was assassinated, and U.S. forces said they killed 40 Iraqi fighters in airstrikes. Meanwhile, the U.S. death toll in Iraq has topped 1,700. There was good news out of Iraq this weekend. French journalist France Obino and her Iraqi translator, Hussein Hanoun, were freed after 5 months of captivity. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, four U.S. soldiers were wounded today in a suicide bombing in Kandahar. The Washington Post is reporting it's obtained another pre-war memo that raises new questions about President Bush's push toward war in Iraq. The eight-page British memo from July 2002 shows Tony Blair's government had concluded that the U.S. military was not preparing adequately for post-war Iraq and that there would be a, quote, protracted and costly post-war occupation of the country. In addition, the Sunday Times of London reports ministers were warned that Britain was committed to taking part in an American-led invasion of Iraq and they had no choice but to find a way of making it legal. The memo was written in advance of the now famous July 23rd Downing Street meeting that produced the Downing Street memo. The recently leaked minutes from that meeting paint a picture of a Bush administration that had already committed to attacking Iraq, was manipulating intelligence, and had already begun bombing Iraq to prepare for the ground invasion. Time magazine is reporting it's obtained new evidence showing how U.S. interrogators are treating detainees at Guantanamo Bay Military Prison. The magazine obtained the interrogation log for a Saudi man named Mohammed al-Khatani, who is supposed to have been the 20th hijacker in the 9/11 attacks. According to the log, the man's head and beard were shaved. He was stripped naked, ordered to bark like a dog, had pictures of scantily clad women hung around his neck. He was also straddled by a female interrogator in a drill known as Invasion of Space by a female. When he refused to drink water, he was injected with an IV tube. After interrogators pumped 3.5 bags of fluid into him, they told him a visit to the bathroom would only be allowed if he started talking. He was also woken up at night by interrogators dripping water on his head or to the music of pop star Christina Aguilera. The 84-page interrogation log is the first such document that's emerged from Guantanamo. The Pentagon defended its treatment. A spokesperson said, quote, Khatani's interrogation during this period was guided by a very detailed plan and conducted by trained professionals motivated by a desire to gain actionable intelligence, to include information that might prevent additional attacks on America. In other news about Guantanamo, the New York Times is reporting as many as six of the detainees still being held at military prison are under the age of 18. One lawyer said his client was only 14 when he was captured. At Guantanamo, the teen has said U.S. forces hanged him by his wrists for hours at a time and that an interrogator pressed a burning cigarette into his arm. The world's richest nations have agreed to cancel debt owed by 18 of the world's poorest countries, including many in sub-Saharan Africa. The announcement comes after years of protests by activist groups, including the Jubilee Debt Campaign, calling on the U.S. and other nations to cancel the tens of billions of debt that have economically crippled nations in Africa and Latin America. Mozambique's prime minister said, quote, "This is an important decision that means we can have more money saved from debt servicing being directed to education, health, infrastructure, and social sectors." While the Jubilee Debt Campaign praised the move as a needed first step, it said there are more than 40 other nations that need total debt cancellation. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. In Iran, hundreds of women protested outside Tehran University Sunday, calling for greater rights and a boycott of the upcoming presidential election. Nearly 90 female candidates have been barred from running for president. The New York Times described the demonstration as the, quote, first public display of dissent by women since the 1979 revolution. Meanwhile, 10 people in Iran died on Sunday in a series of pre-election bombings across two cities. At least 7 bombings were reported. 75 people were also wounded in the attacks. The Iranian government blamed 2 opposition groups, as well as the United States and Britain, for the bombings. The deadliest attacks occurred near the Iraqi border in the largely Arabic city of Avaz. In Washington, the White House has announced that Philip Cooney has resigned his post as chief of staff to President Bush's Council on Environmental Quality. The resignation came just 2 days after it was revealed Cooney had edited government reports to play down the effect of global warming. Before coming to the White House in 2001, he was a lobbyist at the American Petroleum Institute. The White House insisted his resignation was not connected to the new revelations and that Cooney had wanted to take the summer off. Congress has taken initial steps to sharply cut how much money the government spends on public media and radio. On Thursday, the House Appropriations Committee voted to cut $100 million in funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. In addition, the panel agreed to eliminate within 2 years all federal money for the CPB. The committee also voted to cut $23 million for the creation of children's educational shows as part of PBS's Ready to Learn program, which funds Sesame Street and other programs. According to the Washington Post, the proposed cuts are the most drastic since the formation of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in 1973. On Capitol Hill, a hearing on the expansion of the Patriot Act took an unexpected turn Friday when Republican House Judiciary Chair James Sensenbrenner cut off the microphones during a hearing called by Democrats. Sensenbrenner cut short the hearing after the witnesses denounced President Bush's so-called war on terror as well as the treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. All the witnesses had been selected by Democrats. After Sensenbrenner ended the meeting, he had the mics cut as Democratic members tried to continue questioning witnesses. Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "It is quite ironic that at a hearing on the impact of the Patriot Act on civil liberties, the Republicans attempted to suppress free speech." New evidence has emerged linking the Cuban-born Luis Posada Carriles to the downing of the 1976 Cuban commercial airliner. Posada recently sneaked into the United States and is seeking political asylum. He's currently in U.S. custody. The U.S. has refused to extradite him to Venezuela, where he's wanted in connection with the airline bombing that killed 73 people. Newly declassified U.S. documents show Posada said in 1976, quote, "We are going to hit a Cuban airplane." Other declassified documents offer new proof that Posada was used by the CIA as an informer on Cuban exiles in Miami. Meanwhile, the Miami Herald's reporting lawyers for Posada plan to ask an immigration court judge today to set him free on bond while he waits for his immigration status to be determined by federal authorities. And Venezuela is threatening to take the United States to international court if it does not extradite Posada. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said, quote, "We'll have to go to an international court and accuse the United States of violating democratic charters and human rights charters." In Mississippi, the trial begins today of Edgar Ray Killen in connection with the murder of the three civil rights workers 41 years ago during the Freedom Summer voter registration drive. In June 64, Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney were shot dead, allegedly by members of the Ku Klux Klan. The 80-year-old Killen is believed to have been the mastermind behind the killings. Meanwhile, in Washington, the Senate is scheduled to vote today on a resolution to apologize for its failure to enact anti-lynching legislation. While the House of Representatives passed anti-lynching bills three times over the past century, the legislation was repeatedly blocked in the Senate. An estimated 4,700 people, mostly African American, were lynched between 1882 and 1968. And 25 years ago today, Guyanese historian and anti-imperialist Walter Rodney was assassinated. He was 38 years old. Dr. Rodney, a tribute to Walter Rodney, sung by Carl Dawkins here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, the finance ministers from the Group of Eight industrialized nations agreed to cancel the debt of 18 of the world's poorest countries. Finance ministers from the U.S., Britain, Japan, Canada, Russia, Germany, Italy, and France signed off on the package to cancel $40 billion of debt during their two-day meeting in London. The U.S. and Britain presented the proposal on the heels of meetings in Washington last week between British Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush. The agreement will scrap 100% of the debt owed to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the African Development Bank by 18 countries, including Benin, Bolivia, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Ghana, Guyana, and Mali. An additional 20 countries could be eligible if they submit to strict structural adjustment programs mandated by the international financial agencies. Joining us in our D.C. studio is Neil Watkins. He's the national coordinator of Jubilee USA Network. And in New York, Andre, with Indie Media in Britain, has been working with organizers who are planning major protests at the upcoming G8 summit in Scotland. We begin with Neil Watkins of Jubilee USA. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Can you talk about your response to the cancellation of debt, what this means?
Well, Jubilee campaigns around the world, really, across Asia, Africa, Latin America, Europe, and here in the U.S., have been campaigning for more than a decade now for cancellation of debt. And what we've seen so far from G8 leaders has been partial measures, relief of debt, partial relief of debt service payments. For the first time this weekend, under a lot of pressure from movements around the world, the G8 agreed to a principle of 100% debt cancellation, which we think is really an important first step that we want to build on, and that that it's critical that countries be freed of their burden of debt so that they can spend money that they desperately need to spend for healthcare, for education, for clean water, and for other basic needs.
How exactly did this happen? Were you surprised by this? I mean, this is a campaign that has been going on among activists based in Africa, the United States, and all over the world for many years.
That's right. And I think what's changed this year is a couple of things. First, the issue of the Iraq war really played a significant role in that. Tony Blair, I think in response to criticism from citizens across his own country, has been looking to really turn some of his attention to development issues, to issues of Africa. So you've seen strong leadership from the United Kingdom on an agenda for Africa, for debt cancellation, for more and better aid, for different changes to trade policy. And the other thing that's happening, I think, is that there is a left-right agreement here in this country about some of the problems with the international financial institutions, and surprisingly found that even the U.S. Treasury Department was sympathetic to calls for 100% debt cancellation for different reasons than we have called for debt cancellation. But as a result, you saw these two governments coming together and put forward a proposal for 100% cancellation for these 18 countries. And I think the ongoing pressure of global justice movements across the United States, across Europe, across Asia and Africa and Latin America, who have been challenging the IMF and World Bank and this debt for several decades, has really finally begun to take an important step forward, though our journey is far from over.
We're talking to Neil Watkins, National Coordinator of Jubilee USA Network. Now, can you talk about the cancellation of the debt for 18 countries? Then an additional 20 countries would be eligible if they abide by strict structural adjustment programs. What exactly does that mean?
Right. So the 18 countries that will receive 100% cancellation right away are countries that have already gone through what's called the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative of the World Bank and IMF, and they've reached their what's called their completion point. In order to get there, many of them have gone through 6 or 10 years of economic reforms, of privatization, of removing subsidies, of cutting budgets for social services, et cetera. So those countries are now eligible. But in order for additional countries to be eligible, they have to continue to go through those programs. So you're going to continue to see privatization of water, trade liberalization, in order for countries to get to this point of 100% debt cancellation. And our message is clear that though, you know, we think it's an important first step that the G8 have agreed to 100% cancellation, that it is completely, completely unacceptable to force these other 20 nations, and not to mention the nations beyond that that need debt cancellation, to go through these sorts of privatization projects in order to get their debt cancellation. These countries need debt cancellation now without conditions, so that they can provide the services that their people need. In Africa, the HIV/AIDS pandemic continues to kill more than 2 million people every year, and we think all African nations need to see their debts fully canceled to be able to just begin to respond to that pandemic.
We are also joined in our New York studio by Andre, who is with Indie Media in Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
There is a major meeting coming up of the G8 in Scotland. Can you talk about the preparations for them and how this latest news of the cancellation of debt fits in?
Well, that's correct. There's actually going to be three major networks, three major mobilizations happening in Scotland in July this year. The first one is by a group called Make Poverty History, and they're a large coalition of non-governmental organizations, charities.
Make Poverty History?
That's correct. Non-governmental organizations, charities and church groups and other trade unions and so on. There's also a mobilization running under the banner of the G8 Alternatives, which are local Scottish groups as well as organizations such as Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Trident Ploughshares and some other local Scottish trade unions. And then the final group is the non-hierarchical organisation called Dissent, which represents a whole range of groups around the United Kingdom and Europe and around the world. This is an ongoing mobilisation which will continue as well past the G8.
And what are their plans? What are they going to do? The G8 is what's set to begin July 6th?
That's correct. There are a whole range of plans, in fact, going to happen. The summit itself starts on the 6th and runs till the 8th, but demonstrations will be starting in Edinburgh on the 1st of July. There's a bicycle ride that's been actually started from London already and is making its way up there. They're going to end up in a critical mass. There's then going to be two large demonstrations in Edinburgh over the weekend, as well as a counter-summit running in Glasgow. Later on that week, there will be blockades happening around the summit itself, as well as demonstrations at Faslane, which is the largest submarine base in the United Kingdom and also the main port where nuclear submarines remain. other issues, I mean, there are a whole range of issues that are going to be covered by the summit itself, and people have been organising around these. These are things such as not just the debt and trade justice, but also climate change, immigration issues, no borders, things like precarity and employment and civil liberties as well is definitely going to play a large role. Something else that is apparent, obviously, with the demonstrations against the Faslane base is that there is a major link.
And what is the Faslane
base? The Faslane base is the submarine base where the nuclear submarines are kept. There is there's a major link
in
between,
Scotland.
That's correct. There's a major link between poverty and war, and the factors that help create poverty help create war, which then go on to create poverty again, and it's never sort of an ever increasing spiral, really. And this is all played into by the policies that are dreamt up by the G8.
And how is indymedia.org going to be covering the protests as well as the actual G8 summit?
Well, there's been plans by, it's actually indymedia.org.uk that's going to be the primary website covering the protests. There are going to be media centres in both Glasgow and Edinburgh, as well as several mobile media centres that will be going out to the campsites, to the demonstrations, trying to get people to give people the opportunity to upload their news. And there's at the same time as the website, there's also going to be online streaming radio, which will be accessible through the websites. There will be video being produced. There's going to be all kinds of exciting things.
And how does your coverage compare, for example, to the BBC? What do you see as the major differences?
The major difference is that we allow anybody to publish their news. We're going to be a contemporary outlet for people to write what they feel is happening and really to give the word from the streets, as opposed to being filtered through a corporation, which essentially the BBC is.
And finally, Neil Watkins in Washington, national coordinator of Jubilee USA Network. What is the plans of Jubilee now with this cancellation of debt in 18 countries? To what is your presence going to be at the G8 summit?
Well, we'll certainly be joining with colleagues across the UK and around the world at the G8 summit. And our message is that though this is an important first step and an important precedent that was set by the G8 in agreeing to these 18 countries, it must be expanded to include all impoverished countries, that this does not even address the debts of impoverished nations like Nigeria, like Haiti, Jamaica, Bangladesh, just to name a few. So we think it's an important first step, but we're going to be campaigning for years ahead to make sure that impoverished nations, nations in crisis across Asia and Africa and Latin America see their debts canceled, and also see that these economic policies, these structural adjustment policies cannot continue, that we cannot have debt cancellation if it is attached to privatization and forced trade liberalization. And that's the message that we and really hundreds of thousands of others will be bringing to the G8 this summer in Scotland.
Neil Watkins, I want to thank you for being with us, National Coordinator of Jubilee USA Network, and Andre of indymedia.org/UK.
.UK.
.UK. Thanks very much. Okay, this is Democracy Now! When we come back, an FBI whistleblower speaks out about domestic terrorism. He's not talking about Al-Qaeda. He's talking about white supremacy. Stay with us. By the Senegalese group Orchestra Baobab. Senegal is one of the 18 countries whose debt has been canceled. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We broadcast on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, NPR stations, low-power FM and public access TV stations, as well as on PBS stations and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org, closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And our headlines are now translated into Spanish and transcript, as well as MP3 stations around the country and the world taking those. I'm Amy Goodman. While terrorism in the United States has become synonymous with Al-Qaeda, for most of the country's history, domestic white supremacist organizations like the Ku Klux Klan have been the greatest terrorist threat. Some believe they still may be today. Today in Mississippi, the trial begins of Edgar Ray Killen in connection with the 1964 murder of three civil rights workers in Mississippi, Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney, shot dead allegedly by the Klan. And in Washington, the Senate today is scheduled to vote on a resolution to apologize for its failure to enact anti-lynching legislation. An estimated 4,700 people, mostly African-American, lynched between 1882 and 1968. Well, today we're joined by an ex-FBI agent, Mike German, a whistleblower. He resigned from the agency last year in protest of what he saw as continuing failures in the FBI counterterrorism program. German had worked for years going undercover to infiltrate domestic terrorist organizations like white supremacist skinhead groups and anti-government militias. On June 5th, he wrote an editorial in the Washington Post advocating law enforcement pay more attention to groups that produce so-called lone wolf extremists like Timothy McVeigh, executed for the Oklahoma City bombing, and Eric Rudolph, who planted the bombs at the Atlanta Olympics and women's health clinics, a gay nightclub as well. German writes, quote, lone extremists pose a challenge for law enforcement because they're difficult to predict. It's like searching every haystack for a needle. Perhaps we'd have better luck if we paid more attention to the needle factories. He joins us now in our D.C. studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. How are you?
It's very good to have you with us. Well, can you talk first about why you quit and what you see as the great domestic threats today, terroristic threats in this country?
I had been involved in counterterrorism operations for about a dozen years. And after 9/11, of course, the public became aware of how dysfunctional the counterterrorism program was. But there were problems that I knew about for years. So when things weren't changing and the FBI wasn't fixing the internal problems that were causing the breakdowns in communication that were that actually led to 9/11, if you read the 9/11 Commission report, I felt it was my obligation to come forward and report that there were continuing failures.
Mike German, can you talk specifically about what you wanted changed?
I was involved in specific investigations, and I'm not allowed to talk about those investigations particularly. But basically, if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, the diversion was that it was a problem of intelligence. But it really wasn't a problem of intelligence. You had agents in Phoenix who gathered the intelligence, who were aware of one portion of the plot. You had agents in Minneapolis who were aware of another portion of the plot. You had agents in New York who were aware of another portion of the plot. And they all wanted to continue their investigation. The agents on the street are doing their job. They're collecting the information. It's when they report that information to headquarters and request authority to continue their investigation. And that's where the breakdown was. And basically that was happening in my post 9/11 cases, is that same mid-level bureaucracy was hampering counterterrorism efforts. So that's why I reported it to Congress.
Can you talk about the groups that you think need to be watched in this country? And if you can give us a thumbnail sketch of the domestic terrorism attacks, most famous one, of course, Oklahoma City bombing, 1995, Timothy McVeigh.
Right. Basically, that was actually in 1995, Timothy McVeigh's bombing in Oklahoma City. And, you know, what that was their demonstration of the abilities that they had. And clearly, they can do a lot of damage in this country. Any extremist group can do damage. And I think a lot of the problem right now is we're in this kind of area where we're categorizing who's the greater threat. Well, to me, the guy with the bomb today is the greatest threat, and whether he is a white supremacist terrorist, an Islamic terrorist, or an eco-terrorist doesn't really matter to me. My job as a criminal investigator out on the street is to try to stop the threat that's there today. And if we do this sort of ranking where we're only going to pay attention to eco-terrorists because they're the number one threat, or Islamic terrorists because they're the bigger threat, we're probably going to drop the ball in one of the other areas. So I think that the mission is let the agents on the street find out what's happening, but we have to fix that mid-level management area so we can manage the information that they're providing.
How do you infiltrate a group? Can you talk about your own history?
Well, I was involved in a case in Los Angeles in 1992, and in that case, there was a cooperating witness that introduced me into the group. And then I was involved in a second case in Northwest Washington in 1996, and that also involved a different cooperating witness, but it was introductions into the group through public citizens, citizens who saw a problem and wanted to help law enforcement protect the community. And once they introduced me in, then it was up to me to try to figure out who the criminals were within the group and what the criminal activity was and gather evidence of that criminal activity.
Can you talk more specifically, like Los Angeles, what that group was doing?
Well, in Los Angeles, there were actually a number of different groups that we had gotten into, and they were white supremacist groups. Los Angeles in 1992, of course, the community was suffering the aftermath of the racial unrest following the Rodney King police beating. So there was a lot of racial animosity in the city, and the white supremacist groups were attempting to take advantage of that situation to spark a race war. So they were preparing for the race war by manufacturing machine guns and explosives. And one of the cells that we got into was actually already involved in a bombing campaign, and we were able to solve those bombings and recover more explosive devices and stop ongoing conspiracies to bomb synagogues and churches that were attended prominently by African Americans.
Looking at the piece that you did in the Washington Post, Behind the Lone Terrorist Pack Mentality, you talk about every once in a while a follower of these movements bursts violently into our world with deadly consequences. McVeigh, Eric Rudolph, Buford Furrow Jr., Paul Hill, to name just a few, all convicted murderers identified as lone extremists, the most difficult terrorists to stop because they act independently from any organization, or do they? You write, Tim McVeigh seemed able to find a militia meeting wherever he went. He was linked to militia groups in Arizona and Michigan, white supremacist groups in Oklahoma and Missouri, and at gun shows he sold copies of the Turner Diaries, the racist novel written by the founder of a neo-Nazi organization. No one finds such groups by accident. You talk about Eric Rudolph, who planted the bombs at the Atlanta Olympics, two abortion clinics, gay nightclub, grew up in the Christian Identity Movement, which identifies whites as God's chosen people and encourages the faithful to follow the biblical example of Phinehas by becoming instruments of God's vengeance. Aryan Nations, formerly of Hayden Lake, Idaho, was a center of Christian identity thought. Not incidentally, Buford Furrow worked there as a security guard before going on a shooting rampage at a Jewish daycare center in Southern California. And you talk about Paul Hill, wrote of the need to take Phinehas actions to prevent abortions, and was so well known that the news media used to use him to speak in support of Michael Griffin's killing of abortion doctor David Gunn, that Hill later shot an abortion provider himself, should have surprised no one. Give us the landscape of these groups. They're well known.
Sure, they're well known, and they're very well organized, and they're very smart. They understand criminal conspiracy laws. They understand the First Amendment, and they take advantage of those in training their operatives to go out and do these activities. And the point I was trying to make is that we can't look at these as isolated instances. It would be as if we were investigating the mafia and looking at every mafia hitman as a lone assassin and not looking at the underlying organization that was producing these murders. And these people are careful, the leadership are careful about separating themselves from the actual criminal conspiracy, you know, but they do set the motive, they set the method that's used, and I believe that makes them part of the conspiracy. Now, I'm not saying necessarily you can make a criminal case against them, but all I'm saying is if our number one priority is to prevent acts of terrorism, we have to pay attention to these needle factories, because that's what they're producing, is these lone extremist terrorists. And it's not just random violence that occurs once in a while. It's an organized pattern of activity.
I remember during President Bush, the first presidency, Planned Parenthood trying to get the administration to talk about the whole movement of burning, bombing, attacking women's health clinics as a conspiracy, because the same kinds of things were happening around the country, not to mention the targeting of women's health professionals and doctors who performed abortions. They could hardly get an audience with the Justice Department at the time, and the administration was adamant about not talking about conspiracy of these groups. What is the significance of this?
Well, I think the problem is if you blind yourself to the conspiracy, then the chances of them being successful in their next act of lone extremist terrorism is more likely. So, you know, again, I'm not saying that we could necessarily take these leaders into court and convict them, because the whole purpose of their methodology is to separate themselves from the actual criminal activity. But what I'm saying is if we don't pay attention to those leaders, you're going to ensure that the next group is successful. Just as if we were only investigating the mafia one murder at a time and not looking at the underlying organization. And frankly, you know, these groups like the Ku Klux Klan and Aryan Nations have rich criminal histories just as deep as the Italian mafia does, yet, you know, we tend to give them a political status that I don't think is necessarily deserved. Now, one thing to keep in mind, there are political groups within this movement. It's a huge community, and like any community, there's a division of labor, and there are completely law-abiding people within these groups. And as a criminal investigator, when I went undercover, one of the things that I had to do was separate those two out, because there are people who have very strong white supremacist beliefs, but would never, ever engage in violence. And as my role as a criminal investigator, I was there to gather evidence of criminal activity. So I had no interest in talking to those people. I had to try to find who were the criminals. And that's the hard part about law enforcement in a democratic society, but it's something that has to be done. And, you know, in my cases, it was done very effectively. And, you know, I believe the FBI should have replicated those cases more than they did.
You write in your piece in the Washington Post of last week that just 6 weeks ago, self-avowed white supremacist Sean Gillespie was convicted of firebombing an Oklahoma City synagogue. According to a CNN report, Gillespie said he once had been a member of the white supremacist group Aryan Nations, later left the group. At the time of his arrest, he told authorities he was a racist skinhead acting on his own. But before the attack, he videotaped himself stating, "I will film it for your viewing enjoyment, my kindred white power." If he's all alone, who are his kindred? Neo-Nazi ideology is also a leading influence in rising school violence, you write. The March 21st shooting at Minnesota's Red Lake High School was carried out by a Native American teen who praised Adolf Hitler, used the name Native Nazi in internet chat rooms. And the shooters at Colorado's Columbine High School reportedly greeted each other with Nazi salutes and chose Hitler's birthday as the date of their attack. But you rarely hear these incidents described as acts of domestic terrorism. Who defines whether it's terrorism or not?
Well, that's a big part of the problem. And you know, anytime they come up with numbers of terrorist attacks, you got to realize that there's a reporting problem there. You know, a white man beats a black man on the street. Is that just a random assault, or is that a hate crime, or is that an act of domestic terrorism, or is it nothing? Does it not get reported at all? So anytime that the government talks about numbers of terrorism attacks, what they're talking about is the number of attacks that were reported as acts of terrorism. And like the school violence, sometimes it's not even thought of as domestic terrorism. But if neo-Nazi influence is influencing these kids to act out violently, I would argue that that's part of the terrorist movement, and that by paying attention to the neo-Nazi groups that are producing that literature and those websites, we might have a better idea of who might be the next lone extremist so that we can stop it.
With people like Paul Hill, the abortion doctor killer, the whole violent attack on women's health movement, is it also that the administration, with a very anti-choice point of view, brings politics into defining who they'll go after and who they don't? Is that fair to say?
No, I really don't think so. In my experience, the agents on the street have really never let politics get involved, really are very apolitical.
Not the agents on the street, but at the top.
Well, except that that's who actually does the investigation. So, you know, I mean, kind of one of the misnomers about all this talk of reforming the government for counterterrorism, it's not as if the director could say, hey, agent in Des Moines, find me a domestic terrorist case today. You know, he can only deal with what's on the street in front of him. So cases actually get reported up from the street. And, you know, the agents on the street are the ones that are actually making the cases. And where, like what I said before, where it breaks down is when it gets through management. And, you know, I don't believe politics really plays a point in that. You know, whether politics plays a point in these kind of rankings of what terrorist groups are most dangerous right now, that very well may be. But my whole point is that you can't really rank these guys based on their ideology. You have to worry about who's got the bomb today.
Where are the white militia groups centered today in this country, and how hard is it to infiltrate?
You know, they're everywhere. I think one of the big misperceptions about these groups is that they're only out west. They're only up in the Northwest. You know, once you're kind of attuned to their language and their codes and their symbols, I see that kind of stuff everywhere I go. I've, you know, traveled all over the United States and been able to find something that gives me an indication that there's a community there. When a community gets leafleted, typically that's a sign that there is a group that is at least trying to start operating in that community. And if you know, look at these groups, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Anti-Defamation League, that keep track of this kind of information, you'll see that they're spread out everywhere. And keep in mind that they're clandestine groups, so they do their best to hide. So of the ones we know about, there's probably, you know, that's probably just the tip of the iceberg. There's probably, you know, two or three times that many that nobody's ever heard of. When I was working undercover in the Los Angeles case, the one group that we found that was actually involved in the bombing campaign, nobody even knew about them. Huntington Beach Police Department had done a very nice job assisting us in that case in identifying some of these young people, but it was basically a group that was operating completely under the radar.
We're talking to former FBI man Mike German, who quit the FBI in 2004, had been there for 16 years, quit over how the FBI was dealing with domestic terrorism. Do you expect an attack soon in this country?
An attack from domestic terrorists?
Yes. Let's broaden it to, do you expect a terrorist attack in this country?
Of course. I don't think that, you know, you're ever going to stop terrorism. And part of the problem is we use one word to describe very many different things, you know, whether it's the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski or the D.C. snipers or, you know, organized white supremacist groups and organized foreign terrorist groups. We're certainly never going to stop terrorism altogether. I think we just have to try to do the best we can to prevent as many acts as we can. And it requires really a lot of proactive work. And I think one of the big problems is after 9/11, there was generated this idea that criminal law enforcement is somehow ineffective in preventing terrorist attacks. Well, my two cases prove that you could prevent terrorist attacks. I mean, in both of my cases, we actually used criminal law enforcement techniques to prevent acts of terrorism. And unfortunately, the way the intelligence reform has gone has moved from criminal law enforcement to this intelligence model. Well, you know, basically the problem in 9/11 was the American public had no idea how dysfunctional the FBI counterterrorism program had become. But now we're under this intelligence model, we actually know even less about what the government is doing to protect us from terrorism. You know, there's less accountability in the FBI, and I certainly know that there are problems, and I reported those problems to Congress, but so far Congress hasn't been able to even get to the bottom of what I reported to them over a year ago. So there's just no oversight, and those things are really the problems. And until we fix what is internally wrong in the FBI, I don't think it's going to change. I think that we're still at great risk. The 9/11 Commission found that the big problems were the FBI had a poor ability to analyze intelligence that was coming in from the street, that they didn't share information well, and they didn't have a computerized system to share information even among agents. And just last week, the 9/11 Commission Discourse Project came out and told us that, gave us their report card, and it was that the FBI still doesn't have an analytic capability, it still isn't sharing information in the intelligence community, and it still doesn't have a computer system. That's 4 years after 9/11. So, you know, these are all symptoms of one problem, and the problem is mismanagement within the FBI, yet none of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission address that mismanagement. Former Attorney General Richard Thornburgh at the 9/11 Discourse Project last Monday said that, you know, one of the things that bothered him as he was trying to review information about the FBI is through the course of the time that he was there, every time he went to a meeting, it was a different FBI supervisor he was meeting with, that the turnover among supervisors is so rapid that they really don't have an opportunity to learn their job before they're moving to the next one.
Mike German. Last question. That is the latest report that under pressure from the White House, the FBI has agreed to adopt recommendations of a presidential commission and allow the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, to help choose the powerful new intelligence chief at the FBI. The appointment would, for the first time in the Bureau's history, give an outsider a significant role in the selection of a high-level official in the FBI. What do you think about this?
Well, it'll depend on who it is and whether he has the ability to force the managers below him to reform their conduct. It's kind of perfume on a pig to keep changing these top people, because I don't think the top people are the problem.
Mike German, on that note, I'm going to say thanks very much for joining us again. Mike German with the FBI for more than 15 years, quit last year. Did a piece in the Washington Post last week called Behind the Lone Terrorist, a Pack Mentality. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. And to see it-
all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi God prayer. Hound dogs on my trail, little school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. 'Cause I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. About to. I've been there, so I know. You keep on saying go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the wind.
The late Nina Simone, Mississippi Goddamn, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Though we don't often hear about the labor movement in Iraq, the country has a long history of union activism that dates back to the 20s, when the British first began exporting oil from the country. Saddam Hussein banned unions for public workers in 1987 because he feared a progressive movement would topple his dictatorship. When the U.S. occupation of Iraq began, the U.S. authorities refused to repeal the ban. Instead, in September 2003, Paul Bremer, the top U.S. official overseeing the Iraqi occupation, issued an order to privatize the country's state-owned industries, which include its oil industry. But the Iraqi people are speaking out against privatization. At the end of May, a large conference was held in Basra that focused on the threat of privatization of Iraq's oil fields. Oil workers voiced their opposition to privatization and to selling their oil to foreign companies at discounted prices. They also called for an end to the occupation and a withdrawal of foreign troops. The conference was sponsored by the General Union of Oil Workers. The president of that union is Hassan Juma Awad al-Assadi. He is touring the U.S. along with five other trade unionists from Iraq. Joining us now in California is David Bacon, longtime labor journalist who recently returned from Basra, has an op-ed piece about Iraqi unions in yesterday's San Francisco Chronicle. It's good to have you with us, David. Can you talk about the situation of the union workers, the oil industry in Iraq?
Well, the oil union is the largest single union in Iraq, the most powerful union in Iraq, representing about 23,000 workers in the oil industry in the southern part of the country, which is where most Iraqi oil comes from. So on the one hand, it's a very powerful union. It's used its influence to help other groups of workers in the south get organized in the ports, in the electric power generating stations, on the railroads. So it's kind of the heart of the labor movement in southern Iraq. But the union is still under the pressure of these Bremer orders. On the one hand, orders that are moving forward on the privatization of Iraqi state-owned enterprises, including oil and other industrial enterprises. And these orders were written into Iraq's transitional law. So even though Bremer is gone, the present Iraqi government is still bound by the orders that Bremer issued. And unions in Iraq, like the oil workers union, feel that one reason why they continue to enforce the Saddam Hussein law that prohibits unions in the public sector in Iraq is because the occupation wants to keep unions weak while they move forward with the privatization plans. Just recently, for instance, there was a proposal to use Iraq's foreign debt. And remember, under Saddam Hussein, Iraq accumulated an enormous foreign debt, in part to the U.S. because of the purchase of war materials. Now, instead of forgiving that debt, because it was the debt accumulated for these kind of illegitimate purposes, the U.S. and Britain are trying to use the debt pressure to require Iraq to implement privatization orders and also to sign agreements with transnational oil companies that would essentially allow them to get a hold of Iraqi oil at bargain basement prices.
In our Washington studio, we are joined by the founding member of the General Union of Oil Workers, Hassam Juma Awad Al-Assad. He is being translated by Mohammed Tam. We don't have much time, unfortunately, but can you talk about how oil workers are organizing today in Iraq?
هل بإمكانكم أن تقولوا لنا كيف هي وضعية عمال قطاع النفط في العراق؟
وضعية عمال النفط في العراق حالها حال كأي.
The oil workers in Iraq, they're living in a condition that is as much like the rest of the Iraqi workers throughout the country.
حالها كحال أي عمالة في العراق لأنها لن تستحق أو لن تأخذ حقوقها بالكامل لحد الآن.
It doesn't achieve the stance where it enjoys its full rights till now so far.
العمال في القطاع النفطي من والعاملين في القطاع النفطي.
The oil section workers
أخذوا على عاتقهم بعد دخول قوات الاحتلال إلى إعادة البناء والإعمار.
They decided to take over a construction of Iraq after the occupation forces came in.
حيث باشروا بعد 20/5/2003 بإعادة
May 20th, 2003, they started to reconstruct and rehabilitate all the institutions that has been distracted by the Allied forces. So in a way they can revitalize an important sector in Iraq.
لأن كثير من المرافق الحيوية في العراق تتوقف على إنتاج النفط.
Because the condition of many institutions in Iraq depends directly and straightly on the oil production,
كالكهرباء,
such as the electricity,
والأمور التي تتعلق بحياة المواطن الاعتيادية,
almost everything that has to do with the everyday life of the Iraqi citizens.
مع وجود الضغط العسكري على العاملين,
adding to that the military pressure on the workers
في المحطات النفطية,
and the oil fields,
إلا أنهم تحدوا الصعاب,
but they defeated all these challenges,
وعادوا قدر الإمكان ما دمره الأشرار,
and with the limited means they tried to reconstruct what has been distracted.
فبعد شهر من دخول قوات الاحتلال,
after one month,
حاول المجاهدون إعادة التصدير,
came in, people tried to start again the oil export.
على مستوى القطر وعادوا الحياة
throughout Iraq and revitalized.
وبعدها بشهر أيضا تم تصدير أول ناقلة تحمل بحدود 800 مليون برميل عبر الموانئ النفطية العراقية.
Achieved to export oil carrier with 800 million barrels.
وحقيقة هذا العمل قد أذهل العالم جميعا.
Which is so amazing.
حيث كان لا دخل لأي قوة
Without the intervention of any other foreign force except
باستثناء العمال العراقية.
The Iraqi workers.
الذين كما تحدث قلت قد تحدوا الصعاب لبناء
who,
البلد.
As I said, are seeing a great deal of difficulties and obstacles.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Hassan Juma Awad Al-Assad, founding member of the General Union of Oil Workers, elected president July of 2004, translated by Mohammed Tam, David Bacon, veteran labor journalist, joining us from Berkeley, reporting for KPFA, among many other news organizations. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, as well as Maddie Harper. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go there to get our headlines. And we want to welcome a new baby in the world. Our archivists David Rice and Robin have just had a new baby boy named Andrew Rice. Welcome, Andrew. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.